Blog Talk Radio.
Come on, baby, make it hot. Ride the cop till you hit the spot. Come on, baby, make it hot.
Doing the doggy style.
Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yo. Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee.
And welcome to yet another scintillating edition of Naked Soma.
Why do I laugh when you say that?
Because we know that we have no control of what's going to happen. And then we know hardly anyone out there is listening live. If you are one of the few, the proud, the Marines, that tune in the show live and don't archive like all the pussies out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's sort of a culture of archiving, isn't it?
I think so.
I mean, we've pretty much gone, we've gone from screening phone calls, to TiVo, right, to DVR.
The DVR is the best.
I think pretty much satellite radio is, you don't have to listen to that live. Everything's on a loop, archived, right? Pretty much.
I love that, too.
Yeah, so well, here we are on the Blog Talk Radio, you know, the free airwaves. And you don't have to be here when we're here, because we're here to record, and you can lay on your back like a good sape and tune it in when you want to. I mean, iTunes, all that stuff. Basically, we have eliminated time from all these mediums. The only thing you have to really show up for is the Super Bowl, and everything else is pretty much on YouTube.
So
there you go.
Yeah, you're right. Well, that's
so,
all right. I kind of like it that way.
So here we are, basically at the snail end of the somatic summer, even though the real summer started a couple days ago. We're winding down our 12th week here on tomorrow, I guess, is the last day of the Eco Week. So you're wringing out the emotions, and you've been sort of just letting the good times roll, and we are going to be ready to boot up for the somatic summer starting on Friday.
Oh,
and you know what
that
means.
That's when I'm going on vacation, too.
Yes, of course. Well, conveniently, the Eco ducks out of town as the Exos take over the wheel.
With an Exo, even.
Well, why not? Everyone should get to vacation with one at some point. I don't even know if that's possible, but...
Anne Marie and I always have a good time when we go.
Yes.
Our yearly jaunt to wherever everyone else is not.
So in our continuing effort to be up to no good between shows, we are working on a new e-book called the Naked Soma S-List. So.
I still love that name.
Well, I think it fits.
It's good. Yeah, it's great.
So, and we really want to stress... this process of profiling with you guys, because I kind of feel like, yeah, how many years has it been since that that book Blink came out? Like 2-3 years now?
Something like that.
Yeah, and basically we're going to get into a little bit with our guest here, but there's been such a bias towards the cognitive side of this coin, and really what Blink is about is this process he calls thin slicing, but it's called fast cognition. Otherwise known as intuition, you know, in certain circles. And it's based on neurology for the most part, but a lot of it is empirical. It's like, have you been around someone that was, you know, not really anticipating, but sort of just seemed to know where things were going, and they were able to tap into things? I mean, that's kind of what he was talking about. When do you trust it? When do you ignore it? You know, and that's the ecology of that book, Blink. But you know, we're getting into here with profiling is what is sort of the background of what the blinking is doing, which is the stuff you're not conscious of, but it's also providing you with a physical or a body sense, a gut sense of where the truth is. And we're going to get into that a little bit tonight when we talk about the press of Val side of the coin this week, the limitations of therapy.
And it
get
is
off of that couch, turn on your MTV.
There you go.
Yeah. And so, you know, just to kind of give people a kind of a glass-eye view of this, why don't you lay out what the traditional conventional way of doing psychotherapy is as a format. You got your therapist, you got your client, and what's the basic rules of the game?
Well, let me think. I'm going back to my first therapy class. What they told us how to do therapy. They always told us to always ask, and how does that make you feel? Blech. And they told us to look for disparities between the what they're saying and their body language.
They actually taught you about the body language part?
Yep. And that's one of my, who was it? He was actually a social worker, though, that taught the class.
Mm-hmm.
My therapy in the school psychology program was actually taught by a social worker for the most part. He was a pretty impressive guy. He used to pretend he was swimming across his desk, and he'd lay across his desk. He was like, I don't know, 80, and he would swim. And then he'd throw himself in the garbage pail to make a point, and then he'd draw on his forehead with chalk. He was quite a character. As the day is long.
I know you're a teacher and all, but when they say they don't pay these teachers enough, a lot of them missed their calling to join the circus, but...
He actually was a lot different than some of the other psychology professors that I had who would say, you know, keep them a little bit sick and all of the other things that made me nuts.
Well, just as a sort of a way to kind of get the light at the end of the tunnel, so you go into this therapy thing, and what is supposedly the resolution? What is the highest outcome that you can get from therapy, other than that whatever happened to you, you're kind of over with now? I mean, it just seems like, you know, Woody Allen's been in therapy for, I don't know, half a century. It doesn't seem like his behavior has really been radically altered.
No.
So what, other than keeping people from, like, killing themselves and hurting other people, and I always think of, you know, Dr. Melfi and an old Tony Soprano.
Oh, Tony, yeah, another eco.
Yeah, well, remember that last episode when she's figuring out that that sociopaths actually use therapy to perfect their interpersonal skills.
Yep.
Facilitating more sociopathic activity. So I just wonder, are the new therapists that are dealing with things that are like interpersonal neurobiology, like Dan Siegel's work, and they're getting into more of the physical resonance between them and the other person, the coherence, if you will. Is it at the point now? I mean, you got your nose in the psychology tent, where they're even, you know, remotely aware of that what they're doing has limitations, or they still think that it's the talking cure, as they call it.
It depends on how long they've been doing it. I mean, you have to see that it's not always the be all and end all if you've been doing it a while. But I think the new therapists going out into the world have a pie-eyed view of things. Oh, everything's fine. I'll fix everybody. Ugh.
Well, it used to be, I mean, before psychiatry took over psychology, that you had to go through the process. You had to go through, you know, the analysis, if it was Freudian or Jungian or
yep.
You know, and you had to go. You had to be the client first.
Well, we did too. We did triads. We did. We had to go and deal with whatever our points, you know, or weaknesses are, so that when we were in a therapy situation, that we would know whether or not we were reacting to our own crap, or if we were actually being helpful to somebody else. So we definitely had to do that.
And it seems like in the last, you know, 30 years or so, I mean, one of the things we're going to talk about with our guests here in a minute is the kind of the mental and behavioral health world has gone through a couple of waves. I love that word. Since the, I don't know, 60s, 70s, where the first wave was behavior therapy. That was back when, you know, the 1950s, you know, the old Skinner rat kind of days. And then they got into cognitive therapy, which, these people actually think. And they have belief systems that are limiting them. Let's make it cybernetic and let's figure it out. And, you know, things like NLP is a perfect example of using cognitive therapy. And they would combine it with the behavioral work and condition people or use neurolinguistics to switch the way that they associate information and experiences, like we talked about with Joe Bleep a while back. And now we have this third wave, which is what we're going to be talking about now, which is a little different, a little more close to the bone, close to the soma, as it were. So we're going to get into that now. He's the author of, I think, 27 books. It might be more now. And over,
he's unbelievable.
This guy's right. I'm trying to finish one damn book. This guy's got 27 books and 300 peer-reviewed articles. I've got
phenomenal.
Two peer-reviewed articles and no books. How do you get the free time? I got to figure that out. And it's the one that got him kind of a lot of notoriety, I guess you call it, in the last couple of years, is this book called Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, which really addresses his modality, which is called ACT as a word, and it stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. So why don't you get the horn?
All right, and
we will shove off.
Hold on, we're going to do the horn, and then we can get our guest on if I can find the horn. Wait, I'm almost there. Oh God, here we go. Where the heck is it? Does it move? I mean, really? Does it just disappear on me every week?
The horn?
There
the
it
horn
is.
The horn
I got
goes.
It. Okay,
so welcome to Naked Summer. This is Dr. Stephen Hayes joining us from an undisclosed location in the wild of Nevada.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Doc.
Thanks for joining us. Okay, so a couple of things that we wanted to kind of get out there, what we put in the description here is you kind of got a little heat, I guess, or maybe it was the guys that write the titles of these articles about the statement, happiness is not normal, kind of drew a lot of ire, I guess, from the
that's good
positive
stuff.
Well, it's just perfect. The positive psychology people who have been sort of preaching, you know, learned optimism and things like that. And so your stuff, this third wave, how would you define this third wave of psychology, just to give people an overview?
Well, it's mostly relevant to the more empirical wing. I mean, psychology covers almost everything, and you've covered a lot of things in your intro. But the folks who are more science types went through the waves you talked about. And this third wave, you know, they're trying to bring in acceptance and mindfulness methods, values-based methods, more relationship-oriented things, and sort of put them inside the empirical clinical traditions, figure out a way take some of these more ancient spiritual traditions and also older clinical traditions, strip out what is woo-ha, and put what works into packages that can be delivered to people who need them.
I've heard of woo-woo, woo-ha. That sounds advanced.
I like that.
Woo-ha. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, you know, we deal in somatics a lot with this. I mean, you know, if you talk about Genlin's work with focusing or any of these guys
sure.
that do all this stuff that deals with body memory, and there's a whole field out there of body-based psychotherapy now where you've got, I used to say, you know, housewives and nannies, you know, muscle-testing people and doing the healing and using these tools. And again, you're dealing with the sort of that flatland thing that Ken Wilber talks about a lot where you have narrow science, which is external, third party, you know, looking outside and labeling stuff, and all these contemplative disciplines that are dealing with the interior and more the subjective world. And you seem to be sort of almost like riding shotgun in the person's subjective worldview and saying, like your statement, people suffer. Is like, that should be a bumper sticker. I mean, it just seems like it's so obvious, but for a long time, the interventionists seem to say, no, you don't have to suffer. Follow me to the land of fruits and nuts, and everything's going to be better. So how did you get this across to your peers at first when you seem to be flying in the face of everything that they that sort of, you know, heroic effort to save people is sort of the calling? How did you get that across to your peers that maybe we are going a little over for, you know, people suffer, it's okay?
Well, we do want to alleviate suffering, but we've been trying to do it by alleviating pain, which turns out to create a huge amount of suffering, and because pain is sort of part of life. In terms of how you win it over, I think some of our more ancient traditions have been pretty wise about this for a long time, but the new kid on the block, the psychotherapists and so forth, haven't been as wise. And the culture is only too happy to feed you whatever the new cool thing is to avoid all pain in your life, and as long as you provide, you know, pay the right amount of money for whatever the dancing ovoid pill is for whatever emotion you don't like, or whatever particular consumer good is that's supposed to going to make you feel better about yourself. And I think, you know, psychology stumbled into that, especially the more empirical wing, you know, we'll take away your depression, your stress, your worried thoughts. We'll straighten you all up. And it wasn't necessary, it turns out. And actually, you know, we're just learning, you know, as I say, I come out of this empirical wing. We're learning that the pieces that we thought were so critical to that don't really add very much at all to helping people. So some of the things you're talking about of these more intuitive and somatic traditions, I think, are part of it in a way. I mean, if you stop trying to line up all your cognitive ducks in a row and out with the bad feelings, in with the good, and you try to get into what's here now, present, in your experience, your body, your head, your history, what's present, what do you really want out of life, how would you move your feet to make that happen, that's just a lot more certain route towards things that would be positive in people's lives without a lot of the distractions that we've built into psychotherapy over the years.
Now, how do you put the genie back in the bottle when we've been, you know, dealing with things like Prozac and Ritalin, all these psychotropic drugs raining down on the population for 15, 20 years now? How do you just do an about face and say, actually, the pain is beneficial. Actually, the symptoms are the path to enlightenment. Actually, how do you kind of go back and maintain your authority as a, you know, a person of the not of the cloth, but maybe of a of some other stripe, and say, you know, we got it a little mixed up. Actually, we're not supposed to go this far. We've caused more harm than good here. How do you kind of apologize, I guess, in a way?
Yeah, you know, pharmacotherapy when it works is fine, but we have gone way, way too far, and the data themselves show it. So, if you get somebody who's more willing to really look at what we're learning, not just by what our gut feeling is, but what do the data actually show? There's a pretty good story there that we've gone too far, and by the time that you have to worry about the level of SSRIs in your water. You know, and when you catch a fish, it's got SSRIs in it. Something's gone a little bit too far. But what the bigger problem is not just the meds, which can be helpful, but the meta message that's in our commercial culture, our modern culture, as we keep ramping up the media, putting our children in front of this fire hose of human language, but we're giving them no new tools for modern tools to deal with the modern world. You know, we still have our cultural traditions that are based on ideas that are, you know, maybe more appropriate for an agrarian society than the world of internet messages and iPods and, you know, Yahoo telling you within seconds if any perverted thing happened anywhere on the planet. So we just have to evolve some new way of dealing with our own minds and with our own histories, or we're going to have trouble living in a world that constantly is feeding pain into us and is giving us this grand and wonderful solution that never worked, which is if you only drink enough sugar water, you'll feel good all day long. And if that sugar water is the feel-goodism of escape or the particular meds that are there, or if you only had enough money, or if you had the, you know, the really trophy spouse, everything would be okay. You know, those things, a feel-good life is not a live-good life, but, and our spiritual traditions have known that forever. Our commercial culture doesn't know that because it doesn't want to know that, because it's happy to sell you things behind the pain that comes from it.
Now this is the kind of a little hard left here, but how do you deal with the other end of it, where there's not the drugs, but the sort of the Pollyannish end of the spectrum, where you've got people sucking up things like The Secret and What to Bleep, and there's the proverbial groan of the night, where you have people absolutely, we talk about drinking the Kool-Aid, they're reading the Kool-Aid, and they can sit around saying things like, I create my own reality, and live there. And you've got,
For a while. They can live there for a while.
Until they lose seminar,
There's a grain of truth, of course, in all these things, or they wouldn't sell at all. And there's a charismatic leader and a good writer or whatever, or they wouldn't sell. But if you just follow them over the years, if you're old enough, you've seen these things come and go. If you're a more science skeptic like myself and you actually ask, you know, where's the evidence, there's a lot of things that will make you feel good now and make you feel or live a lot poorer very soon. And so these waves come and people sort of feel the pop, and there is a pop in there, But what they're not ready for is the down that comes with it. I mean, there's a sense of responsibility that comes, for example, I'm creating my own reality that can activate people, get them out of a victim role. But on the other side of that, when they're raped for no reason that has to do with them and so forth, what are you going to do with that? And, you know, you've got these insane things where people are willing to take the next step and say, you know, people in concentration camps, that's their own fault. That, you know, it's the same thing with the secret kind of message. You know, if you only focus enough on the positives, that'll activate people. But on the other side of it is, how do you then deal with the fact that you know many, many, many people are going to crash and burn around that same message a year from now?
And
it's not responsible.
And a lot of it comes from that fuzzy edge between, like, religious tradition and spiritual practice, and where these things are not clearly defined to the uninitiated, and they're gullible, and they want, like you said, they want to move away from the pain, they want to avoid the suffering, they've been told upstream that they're special and they're unique and they should be, you know, basically yawning sunshine, and all of a sudden, you know, life intervenes and says, no, the way you're going to grow is you're going to go take this other path. And it just seems people are unwilling. Like, we experience it a lot. I guess maybe this is an East Coast, West Coast bias, but on the East Coast, the fast part of fast temporary relief cannot be stressed enough. The faster you can get somebody out of whatever pickle they're in, the more people come to the rodeo. And they're not. And again, don't make me think, don't make me work, don't make me feel, don't make me process. Just basically get the car wash, hose me off, and send me right back out into the masses out there. And to get people to be personally responsible for the things that they're experiencing is another step. So how does, I mean, I know some of the origins of your work is in relational frame therapy. How do you get someone to look at the way that they got to the point where they had the suffering and pain come up and then move forward from there using the new tools of ACT or ACT?
Well, what we're trying to do is we've been working on this for 30 years. I'm a sort of a California ex-hippie exposed to the, you know, all of the excesses of the 60s and what I remember of it. And
so you went to EST and you did all that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the Zen retreats and all the rest, and there's some wisdom in that. But what seemed to me is more important is that we needed to try to get a scientific understanding of how the human mind works this way to produce these kinds of outcomes. So I don't want to just be in a position of referring people to the local ashram, go do a 10-day retreat or whatever. To me, that's not very progressive because those things were already here, thank you very much. And there's lots of folks within 50 miles of where you are doing a weekend retreat, perfectly well-trained, know how to do that, and they don't need shrinks to suddenly nominate themselves as gurus. So what we tried to do and what we've done over these 25, 30 years is really try to come with an understanding of what happens when people narrow down their repertoire and do the same thing over and over again, even though it doesn't work. And what we figured out some sources, and the biggest sources are you get entangled with what your thoughts say literally, you get avoidant of what you're feeling, sensing, and remembering, and you sort of forget what you really want to be about anyway and start thinking that if you could just clean up the mess, then you could start living. And meanwhile, the clock is ticking, the mess is not getting cleaned up, life is not being lived, your kid's getting older, you wonder, you know, how long you're going to be on the planet, you're facing your own mortality.
I was there last night.
It doesn't mean anything to you. So the spiritual and religious traditions have some answers to this, but they wrap it all in a whole set of practices that frankly can't reach Joe Sixpack, can't reach normal people in the modern world where you don't have 10 days to be silent necessarily, or you don't have the money to do it, and you don't necessarily relate to the ways that wisdom used to be delivered in the culture. All of the social groups and spiritual and religious traditions that are traditional are weakening in a way, and so, except some that are scary, frankly, the more kind of reactionary wing of it. And so we think we found a way. We think we've developed, you know, not the way, just a way, and something that it's more humble and sort of small steps, but can help us rein in this organ that we've got between our ears that is telling us the right answer, and it doesn't work as the right answer, and so it tells us another answer, and we do that, and we do that, and we do that, and never sort of catch that we're being tricked again, but by entanglement with what, after all, is an organ to help you solve problems and live, not your master. It's not the driver of the bus. It's not who you are. There's more to you than your logical reasoning and problem-solving capacity. So, and especially in the modern era that really has fed this intellectual and verbal side to the point of insanity, we need to back up and sort of climb back into our whole selves, into our bodies, into our histories, get present, look at what we really want to accomplish in our life and move forward. We think we have some ways of doing that by teaching people the trick of human language, how the mind works, and some alternatives to the usual ways that we've tried to deal with the messes that it can create.
So is it sort of like a reverse engineering of things like NLP and things that are dealing with, like you said, the verbal illusions that we sort of buy into that creates the narrative and like I said, getting people out of their heads and letting them understand that they can physically communicate with themselves in a much more raw and much more grounded way than they ever could mentally, and keep people kind of like basically on the earth instead of in their heads and floating around?
That's part of it. I mean, that's the name of the book, you know, get out of your mind and into your life. You know, we don't mean get out of your mind, go insane. We're meaning, you know, step out of the entanglement with this mental organ, which is constantly providing us solutions. The whole way that the mind works is a discrepancy-based problem-solving mode of mind. That's why it evolved. That's why we're here. You know, we're weak, slow. We don't have big teeth, but we took over the planet because we could use this organ. But it's like that comedian who said, I used to think my mind was the most important thing about me until I realized which organ was telling me that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we really do need to sort of bring this tool to heal, or it will carry us into planes going into buildings, dropping bombs on whole countries to make us safe, and never mind that, you know, the dancing ovoid for every problem and all the things that we're seeing in our kind of feel-good culture that we've created that is spreading from the West to the entire world without creating a lot of benefit for people. So,
hey,
yes, it's related to those things. The difference is what we're trying to bring to it.
Okay.
You're talking to a science geek. You're talking to a bottom-up. You know, I want to know what the processes are. I want to see them in the lab. We're going to figure it out. And, you know, we think we've figured out actually what the core of human language is. Pretty bold thing to say. We've got about 70 studies that we think shows that. And we think we're learning something about how to scale that into technologies that help people become more flexible, more connected with their values, more present in their own bodies and able to move with their behavior.
Now, are you more on the side of a Steven Pinker as far as the language instinct, or are you more on the side of you know, like the cognitive guys that think it's cultural, and you know that verbal language is more kind of an outside-in thing, or that it's not, you know, biologically rooted in us. Which way did you go with that?
Well, we certainly have some kind of biological capacity. If I can tell you let me tell you what the core is, what we've discovered.
Yeah, what's the core?
Human infants, if you train them something in one direction, given this, pick that out of an array. Okay.
Okay. How old are these babies?
12 to 14-month-old babies.
Okay.
If you flip it around and now give them that and say, which do you pick out of this array and include the this you started with? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Train A to B. B has one of several things. Now put B there. Make A one of several things. They'll pick it quite readily. We're the only creature on the planet that does it. The language-trained chimps don't do it. And don't be talking to me about your dog. I know your dog's real smart, but, you know, the usual objection I get, you know, Bowser's real smart and he would do it. No, he wouldn't. We have 25 years trying to get it. And we know that this part, the part of the brain that lights up when you do that is exactly the part of the brain that lights up when I ask you what a metronome is or the definition of an odd word.
Huh.
It's the ability to go backwards and forwards. And what that does changes everything for human beings. So, yeah, it's biological in the sense that we have the capacity to learn that, but one thing we do know is it's learned. If you put babies in closets, they don't learn it. We know, because we have the direct training evidence now, that these kinds of relational abilities, and they're not just association. I gave you an example of what a word means, but it includes things like being arbitrarily to say that this one's better or bigger or before and after or faster or anything like that, all opposite, same, all of these relations that are no longer bound by the properties. You know, a nickel can be smaller than a dime to a four-year-old. It isn't to a two-year-old. That ability is critical to problem-solving and language. If you don't do it, you don't have normal language functioning. It comes there so early, it can't be as a result of language functioning. And if you don't do it, you can't solve problems. I mean, you've got to be able to imagine futures that have never been to be able to function well as a human being. But that also means you can imagine panicky things that have never happened. You can regret the past and get entangled with trying to change it, even though, as far as we know, time goes in one direction and not two. You can become entangled in trying to create your own life as a problem to be solved instead of a life to be lived. And that's just because this organ, which is so damn useful, doesn't know when to stop. It will go everywhere you are. It'll even say it is who you are. And so you know, there's a variety of methods, whether it's silence and meditation or taking enough drugs that you can hardly see which side is up, or that try to rein it in. We have to find a way to put that into the culture and get people to sort of bring this mental tool to heal as opposed to having it run us. But that's the core of it.
That's a Texas-sized core you just put out there for us. And so most people, like I said, they don't really link in brain development with personality and with life choices and all the stuff that's on their windshield now. And I know in our work we deal with a lot of Barisi's research on brain development in terms of orientation, internal orientation. So a lot of this has to do with, you know, what is the system up to neurologically at that critical junction you just talked about, 12 to 14 months. If you took a baby a little slightly younger that doesn't have the same capacities, then that choice they make there would not be, to me, that would be sort of a way to kind of no hypothesis, younger baby, maybe not so good. We've had people talk about dialectics and other things where you're dealing with all these biomarkers developmentally where you get more complex, you get more associative in the way you process. You go from opticoding to lexicoding, and all these things are happening. So, you know, most of us aren't walking around with sort of a ledger sheet of the first 6 years of our development. So you take the person that's 25 or 30 that's been in and out of therapy, been in and out of group stuff, been in and out of workshops, and they stumble on, ACT, or they get onto your listserv or something like that. And it's, you know, you give an acronym here about it, you know, that basically says you're moving from fear, which you say fusion of thoughts, evaluation of experience, avoidance of your experience, and the reason giving of your behavior. That's the brain taking you back into the loop is what you're telling us here, that cognitive entanglement part of it. And then you're suggesting that we go the other direction. ACT is the process of accepting your reactions and being present, which is kind of stopping the train of thought and saying, here and now, I accept my reactions. Almost like in general semantics, they talk about a semantic reaction to language. It's like, oh, my body's reacting to these words. It must mean I have some, you know, some memory in here that's making this bubble up. And then this choosing of a valued direction, the second step, is what I want to kind of explore a little bit, and then taking action. How do you move from, okay, I'm a little skittish, okay, I'm a little neurotic, whatever the label I've had on me here, I'm ADD, whatever the heck it is, and then this choosing of a value direction, when most of these people are functioning from belief systems, not really values, how do you make that transition without using language as the bridge?
Well, you've got to use language to a degree because we talk about everything. So what we're trying to do is get cracks in the system, holes in the wall, air in the room. We're not trying to, you know, suddenly become different kind of creatures than we are. We're languaging creatures. But part of what language tells you to do is to solve this problem of your own life by getting the results you want, the emotional results, the cognitive results that you're evaluating without noticing that the process that you're engaging in, as you think about it that way, is discrepancy-based. It creates your own self as a problem. I'm not there yet. Well, when are you going to get there? I mean, you're always going to have a problem. You're never going to get there. And so how do you get here? Well, it doesn't give you a way to get here. It's like you can't get here from there. And so the mind doesn't know how to get present. It didn't evolve for that. It evolved to solve problems, which is based on I'm not there yet. And so what we do instead is teach people to go into the pain, not as an end in itself, but as a way of bouncing back into what you care about. I mean, one of the costs of not going into your pain is you don't even know what you care about. You're talking to somebody who's an anxiety disordered person by history. It's part of how I got here as a social phobic, etc. You know, you look at something like social phobia, people who are afraid of other people are people who want to be with other people and make a contribution to other people. Why the heck would you be afraid otherwise? But you can't get to that if you're not willing. If you create the fear itself as a problem, you're not learning what's really going on with you. And so I think we take people into the pain and then right back out. It's the flip side of the coin of what your values are. The places that you can be hurt or the places that you care about, would you be willing to acknowledge that hurt and move forward towards what you care about? You want a simple model anybody can understand. You're rejected in relationships. Your mind tells you the solution is to never be so vulnerable again. In other words, you can never be close to people because if you're close to people, they can hurt you. So because you want to be close to people and got hurt, the mind tells you, here's this great solution. Stop trying to get close to people. It'd be like dropping a glass of water if you're thirsty and your solution is to swear off any kind of liquid. And it doesn't work for people. What we need to do is carry the vulnerability that comes, let's say, from rejection and step forward into connecting with others, sharing your values, sharing your vulnerabilities, which is what intimacy is. And to do that, the acceptance part empowers the values part. You won't find out what you really care about if you aren't willing to get present with who you are, what vitalizes you, what motivates you, what you care about, and a big part of that, where you can be hurt.
Mm-hmm. What you're getting at here is some of the neurobiology that talks about that primary bonding experience. I mean, I know in some of the things I've investigated, like Tomatis method, where you're dealing with sonic birth and some of the things, even with dialectics and some of the other modalities that have come up, it really is about allowing yourself to get back to that primal vulnerability so that you can feel supported and loved. And the interpersonal neurobiology about needing another brain to help your brain develop. And when you shut off and you go closed-headed, you're kind of stuck in that, like you're saying, that limbo where the problem becomes the obsession, and then you go into avoidance patterns. And it's sort of like pathology, in a way, is sort of the raw material for the healing process, is what you're telling us there.
I think it is. And, you know, we're neurobiological organisms, so it's reflected in all of that. But what we really need is, since we don't know how to go in directly in changing the brain, the brain is a plastic organ. It's a dependent variable, not just an independent variable, the way that the scientist types talk about. I mean, it's affected by everything we do. Our conversation right now is literally changing our brain in the moment. Can we get down to what the processes are that have sort of built this part of the brain that is way over-exercised, having to do with this problem-solving mode of mind, and get another mode of mind going in here, which we also know how to do. There isn't anybody listening to this who doesn't know something about this, which is more connected to the spiritual side of ourselves, getting present, mindful, open, flexible, conscious, and connected to action that is vitalizes us, motivates us. As you sort of do that, and we can, you let go of the chains, and you sort of fight your way out of this cognitive paper bag that we're in, and start moving ahead, you get habits of mind that actually literally you can see in imaging studies and so forth that will support you in having, you know, behavioral habits that are serving your interests instead of these kind of reactive mental states that are so well grooved that you're constantly fighting yourself just to be where you are, know what you care about, and get moving in that direction.
So how do you bring this ecology, this great set of tools, into your healing relationship? Say someone's already in, you know, psychotherapy, already in a cognitive situation, and they stumble on ACT, and they read your books, and they go, you know what, Doc, you know, I read this stuff, and I'm really starting to think that maybe I want to go this direction. How do you integrate it with things that seem like they don't really complement really well, or even fly in the face of it? Do people have to just suddenly drop out of therapy and just in mass?
Well,
there
are things going on in lots of forms of therapy that resonate with what we're learning. And, you know, we've done a randomized trial of our book alone and know that it produces significant benefits just by reading the darn thing. I tell people to skim it, sit with it, wait a few days. If it speaks to you, go back and do it slowly, and it'll take you about 2 months. If you stumble over an exercise, skip that, come back to it. It gradually sort of teaches you skills that have benefits. One of the cool things about it is the impact that it has empirically is about twice as large at follow-up than it is right after you read the book. So you plant seeds that just grow in your life. You begin to watch these patterns, try some new patterns, they work better, and it sort of shapes you forward. I don't think it's a matter of transformation, like flipping a switch or something suddenly. And for the reasons you mentioned, we've got a lot of habits and a lot of sort of exercising parts of our brain that we need to sort of focus on less. But you know, we also, if you Google ACT or Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, you'll find a website with lots of therapists out there who are learning and using these things, so people can get access to these folks. And you mentioned the third wave. The third wave is bigger than just ACT. I mean, there's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, functional analytic psychotherapy. There's a family of folks. Frankly, it's the hippies grown up, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But there's a family of folks who are figuring out in a very empirical, wise way, it's nothing too silly, nothing too scary, how to do this step by step. And I also have things like listservs. They're all free. You know, we don't have any of that kind of certification, special little fees, tithing to Reno, Nevada, or anything like that. So we're going to do this as an open system. We're sort of Linux. We're not seeking to be Microsoft.
Well, I mean, this whole notion of open source, you know, this is one of the reasons why we did the Blog Talk show, was because, you know, talking about a backwater science, semantics is buried somewhere in one of those mountains. You went to one of those S workshops probably, and it got stuck out there on the other side of the Rockies pretty much. And really what we see in semantics is that they sort of avoid a lot of the cognitive stuff, unless you read some of Hannah's work and Strozzi and some of the other guys that deal with leadership and more of you know, the body at work, the body at home, that kind of thing, where you're dealing with this first-person awareness that you're talking about. Now, your association is the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science. It's contextualpsychology.org, and that's where the public and the professional can go to get sort of their feet in the wet sand of ACT and start looking at this stuff as a personal, practical way to kind of unlearn a lot of things that the culture kind of installed in your head, a little kind of like the dirty memes of the mainstream, so to speak. And so I just want to kind of bring you a full circle here. So looking at these things, again, you got Sigmund Mihaly with all his work on consciousness and flow and peak activity, and there's been so many messengers, I guess the word is, in the last 10 years, and you know, I can't finish the show without mocking Deepak Chopra or some of the other guys that brought information into the Western culture from other cultures, whether it's Eastern or whether it's Hindu or whatever it is. And it was always seemed to be laced with this sort of syrupy spiritual goo that made it so that you had to almost go through an indoctrination or some type of ritual in order to learn it. And you're saying this stuff is plain on the nose on your face. I mean, you've got this 3-pound universe in your head, and it's full of a lot of junk and spyware and stuff, and you can tease it out and sort of, you know, get it back to its plasticity by just making a certain amount of consistent conclusions about what the world really consists of, and this whole notion of self as context. And that's really what I really resonated with when I read it, as far as the semantic part, because semantics fundamentally is self and surroundings, that dialogue, that relationship, that Möbius strip. So one of the things that we looked at in terms of making this real for people is this concept of coherence, and we had Stephen Elliott on about a month ago, I guess, talking about the science of breath and heart rate variability. Do any of your studies look at heart rate variability as a physiological marker for people that are integrating some of this stuff?
There's a few studies that have looked at various kinds of neurobiological measures, and heart rate variability has been you know, talked about and so forth, and I think most of the folks have done neurobiological studies have been more doing imaging or lateralization or
look at
things
the brain.
Of that kind.
Yeah.
But you know, what's going on in these messengers, I think, is that the culture knows it has a problem, and when cultures sense that, the people in it sort of try to find another way, and we just have to pray that we can find another way quick enough that we can deal with what we've unleashed on ourselves by our technology and science and change in human culture that has put us into a place that we did not evolve to be in. You know,
that
we did not.
Ooh-ha.
We're being exposed to 20, 30 times the number of words, judgments, horrifying images than our grandchildren were. And you just have to be in a different place to deal with that. And where are they turning? Well, they're turning to the ancient spiritual and religious traditions, which is fine. But, you know, these things are around when people are eating dirt, practically. This is not, you know, modern stuff we're talking about. Can we take what's inside those traditions that are important, strip away the stuff that's unnecessary, pull them at the joints, and create sort of modern methods for a modern world? And there's people out there, like the ACT people, but not just them, that are trying to do that, not in any sacrilegious way. We're not doing it because we want to trash ancient traditions. But, you know, frankly, if that were it, you wouldn't need the shrinks, you wouldn't need the scientists, if that alone were it. I think you see in all those messengers a yearning. People are seeing the relevance, feeling that there's something of importance there. But we know, and you mentioned a few, there's a lot of stuff in there that is probably unnecessary, that is far too airy-fairy. And so can we figure out a way? Unfortunately, that's slow. It takes a while to figure out a way and do it responsibly. It's going to require mixing these Eastern insights and Western science. It's going to gradually sort of weed out what's unimportant, find what is important. And we think we've done enough after, you know, we didn't publish the first book on ACT until 20 years into our developmental work, and the first popular book into almost 30 years. So we think we've done enough that we've got something to give away. There's now something like 25 ACT books, about 15 of them are for the popular folks, and they're easy enough to find. Just Google them and you'll find them.
Yeah, yeah, and actually, you know, you can go to Wikipedia, there's a whole thing on ACT up there, just
sure.
Plug it in or plug in, you know, Stephen's name. He's got links on there. And so just to wind it down, what is the most common misconception about ACT from the outside in? Someone that just, again, they're looking for the panacea. They're looking for the, you know, the Howie Mandel $1 million suitcase. I mean, they're looking for that. How do you hose them down and say, like you say, one of the things about the book is that the advice cannot cure the reader's pain. It advises sufferers to not fight negative feelings but accept them as part of life. Happiness is not normal. So how do you, what's the most common misconception about ACT when someone is an initiate and just says, "How I found this great thing called ACT and I don't know what to do?"
Well, there's probably two things. One is people think that it is Buddhism or a spiritual tradition. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's Western science, kind of humble, you know, bottom up, and open source coders. These, you know, there's no woo-ha there. We're trying to really get thousands of folks involved in the development of it, but there's no tithing, no fees, no certification. So we're going
right.
to do it that way. The other thing is that I think people sometimes initially come to it thinking that it's another answer that is a quick fix. You know, the problem with the quick fix answers is it constructs yourself as a problem to be solved, and you are not a problem to be solved. This is a life to be lived. It's a process to be engaged in. There is no outcome. There's no speedometer glued to your head. So let's do this thing one at a time. Start doing things that are more sane, more values-based, more in your interests, more flexible, and life will open up in the area of relationships, work, and recreation, Freud's big three. That's it. That's your job. Your job as a human being is to work out how to do that and to do it in the world you were born into, which turns out is a pretty different world than your grandparents were born into, so you got to learn some new methods. And the you is a plural you. We as a human culture have got to figure out how to ride this tiger of language that we've unleashed on ourselves. And it's going to, you know, not an instant quick fix. You don't need to be fixed. This is a step-by-step get into your life.
Jeez, I'd say amen, but it sounds non-secular. well, thanks for joining us here on Naked Somer, and welcome to the nation. And we will definitely get link up on the Ning site, send it over to your folks, and hopefully get some people crossing over and learning some of our stuff. It was a very Watts Wallach kind of evening here, kind of going through the language barrier with easy pass for a change.
Yeah,
so yeah, hopefully get you back on and do a little panel stuff when we get some of the other people out there on the frontiers of psychology to bat some of these ideas around again. So thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Good deal, Mark and Val. Enjoyed it.
See ya.
Take care.
Bye. See, now I can go into my new semester of teaching with at least one psychologist in mind that doesn't piss me off.
They have reason to be again.
Yeah. That's good stuff. Maybe I should bring some of that into the classroom.
Hmm. And to all you other people out there that are naysayers, I bring up Bob Costas.
Good riddance, fuckface. So long, you fetus-faced windbag. Good luck managing a Denny's, douchebag.
There you go. Keep selling your Prozac, you humps. Ah. Wow. Well, he said a lot of things. I might have actually listened back to my own show and be an archive for stuff.
You know,
I was writing notes all over the place.
That was such a good... I just sat here going, holy crap. Holy crap, the whole time in my head, and I said absolutely nothing, but I soaked it all in.
Walk the dog, mow the lawn, clean the pool,
the
show like you usually do?
I actually didn't do anything but put one thing in the sink that was annoying me because it was sitting here.
I actually knocked over a speaker about 25 minutes in out of complete random acts of kindness to myself. But that was amazing. I mean, like I said, a lot of the stuff that I'd read spoke to me, and if anyone's listening to that with a somatic ear, you heard the echo in there inside,
yep.
You know, lurking with his exo coating on, you know, communicating a technology and a method and a science and all that stuff. But something tells me deep down underneath we've got, you know, the tie-dye jeans on and, you know, the bare feet. And, very happy
good.
To be, you know. Hanging out on Eco Mountain there. And every time we do a show with Eco, I feel like I could live forever. I tell you.
I know. We should just have Ecos on the show.
I'm
the rest of
you
just go screw yourselves,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, except the Yackle Ball lady. She
can
come on
Eco all the time. Well, she's got a little Eco in her, that one.
But she's so zestfully clean, Anto. She's such a believer.
Yeah, she is.
We love the Yackle Ball. Yes.
We do. We definitely do.
So let's segue to a little cultural... sort of reference point for this, and you wanted to play a little Bob Newhart, I believe?
Yeah, well, we still have some time here.
Okay.
So we can actually bat around some other ideas for a little bit.
Yeah.
We actually finished pretty early. You know, I just love the idea that they're taking the Western crapola and mixing in some Eastern stuff. That is so good, because what's wrong with the Western stuff is that it's got no Eastern stuff in it. And he's doing it.
You've got Buddhism in my brain science.
You've got
brain science in my Buddhism.
Now you made me hungry, you ass. Now I want peanut butter. Damn it.
Yeah, let's see. I want to do this one first. I'm going to do this one
first.
Go
ahead.
The gift from the self-esteem fairy.
There you go.
Yeah, this got to be lowered. What is wrong with Block Talk? It's so freaking loud. My head is going, meh.
I'll see another one here.
Where was I? Oh, you were last seen hiking up Mount Ego.
We got Niles.
Niles is funny as hell. Could you understand what it said? You got to lower it. It's so
freaking
loud.
I'm
going
to lower it to 70 for this next one here. Let's see.
So you're still waiting on that spine donor.
There you go.
I'm still waiting on the spine donor. That's so good. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to lower these. I'm going to have to redo this. I don't know what happened at Block Talk. Why do they have to torture us?
Well, you got to learn your lesson. Here, let's see if the Bob Newhart theme will play here.
Get it. Oh, got to put it lower.
Hello. It's 70.
Loud. Still loud. Good, though.
Everyone's dancing. I should wake up to this every day if I ever went to sleep. Cheap ending, though. It's all a dream, you know. Are the whole theme still playing?
Yeah.
What I hate about Block Talk is you can't stop these things once you start them.
Yeah, you can.
Well, we'll stop it.
Well, I can't because you started it.
Oh. Well, I gotta stop it.
It's too late now. It's done.
Stop you,
there
hope.
You go.
Oh, wow.
There you
it's
go.
A whole new freedom for me.
That, there you go. Well, if you start it, you can stop it, but you have to be careful not to click it twice, otherwise it starts yet again.
Boy, I wish marriage was like that. If you can start it, then you can stop it.
Yeah. Stop this crazy thing. I got to get out of here.
Yeah, Jane, stop this crazy thing. Well,
I was saying. Oh,
exactly.
God.
Oh, Jetsons, come on. A lot of that stuff, we didn't get into it with him, but the individual seems to be the focal point in ACT, and how do you deal with the group dynamic? Now, you talked about the society, but that's a bigger group, with family, couples, all that stuff. I wonder if couples can go to ACT therapy, and you know, and they're both present, but one's a woo-ha, and the other one is a science geek, and how do you get that? You know, I mean, I'm just curious to see how they would blend those things, because it seems like it cleans out the individual SAPE, but when the SAPE has to talk to another SAPE who maybe doesn't exactly understand that they could put down the Prozac.
Right.
How do they get past that? Because it seems like it people get, I don't want to say religious, but they definitely get adamant about their medication.
Oh, yeah.
And they think that pill is they need to get that junk in their blood to make their head work, and it just kind of cracks me up.
Well, you know, when I was having the panic attacks,
mm-hmm.
I went on a couple of different medications. One of them made my private parts itch, so I'm
Ooh.
Trying to teach college, and I just wanted to take the claw end of the hammer. And then...
Thank you for sharing.
And then the other one made me so jittery that I had to take Ativan with it so that I could...
Clap on, clap off, the clapper.
There you go.
You know, and then, you know, after a while I said, you know what, none of these do anything but give me side effects. The hell with this. And then that's when I met the Reiki chick, and then that's how I got into the Reiki, and then I don't need any medications. And if I ever feel any panic coming on me, I just go back into my little Zen world, and it goes away. It's a beautiful thing.
It just, like I said, a lot of the stuff with medication, and maybe someday we'll get... our other eco pal out there on the West Coast, David Goodman, to come on from the Newport Neuroscience Center, and his whole experience working in NIH when, in their formative years, when they were just like, you know, dealing with the health of the Utes, and they had a choice to make, and they chose mental illness over mental health,
uh-huh.
And ever since they did that. You know, the CDC and all that stuff lined up to basically treat conditions rather than deal with developmental stuff, which is a little saucy and hard to do because people had to actually do things for themselves, and government didn't like that, and the pharmacocracy, you know, sort of lined itself up around it, and you ended up with, you know, maybe basically 30 years of pickling people.
That's right. And let me just say this for the Zoloft that did that to me.
Court, I'm worried about the beaver.
Okay.
Wow. Well, we've pretty much beaten therapy to a pulp tonight. If you're in therapy, go in next time and just walk into your therapist, kick him in the shins, and just say, I have a website for you, you sycophant, you, you ninny.
God.
I keep thinking of, what the heck is it, Boys in Saddles. You sissy Marys? Don't double-leaf. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da.
Oh, it. God.
Great horny toads!
There you go. So next week we're having a little chiropyro night to get us into the 4th of July feel, inviting chiropractors from under rocks that even I can't name.
Right.
To be part of our panel discussion about the limitations of the bodywork side of the
mm-hmm.
coin. So this week we took the couch trip and got you bastards off the couch, whining, you whiny ninnies.
Yeah, knock it off already.
Hey, come on already. Yeah, well, you get over yourself. It isn't that important.
That's
right. Let me complain again. And to get you back, you know, when people come in for the miracle of the chiropractic adjustment, and we're going to be talking about the limitations of matter. So bring your little secret books, your archive and fags. And, God, I'm pretty nasty tonight. And,
I like
we will,
to like that, though.
Well, whatever, you know. And we'll we'll attack that next week and see if we can come to some conclusions before the fireworks.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, the chiropractic profession is so honest and so forthright.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They all are, all professionals.
Yes. And if Matt McCoy is archiving the show, get your butt to a phone, you philo ninny. so afraid of his own shadow. Boo! There he goes again.
Oh, God.
They're going to get me. Yeah. So in honor of our guest tonight, Stephen Hayes, we'll close tonight with a little Johnny Cash.
Beautiful.
And we'll see you next week here on the Nick and Soma Radio 9 o'clock on the east side of the country, this great country of Oz. What are we going to be, like 200 and something years old next week? I don't even know.
Something like that.
piece of crap country. Anyway, thank you for joining us again for Festival and myself, Travel Light. We will see you next Wednesday.
Who farmed the Phoenix Valley in Arizona land? Down the ditches a thousand years, the waters grew Iris people's crops, till the white man stole their water rights and the sparkling water stopped. Now.